My name is John Fish. This is a series called The Helping Professions Hurt. And the first one is why the helping professions are dangerous. I think it would be good to find out just from a few people, say, what you do for a living or what you think you'd like to be doing. Michelle, what would you like to be doing after Holden? Would you have any idea?
Well, I have to go to seminary yet, but then I'd like to work in a hospital as a chaplain.
Great. How about someone else over here?
I'm a programmer.
Programmer.
At computer programmer.
Right. People programmer, right. Anyone else? Yeah.
I'm a registered nurse.
Registered nurse. Dar, how about you?
What are we saying?
What do you do?
I'm a head resident for a woman's dorm in college.
All right.
I'm planning to go to seminary this fall.
You're another seminarian.
Worked in the social field.
Social field. How about some of the men over here?
Physician.
Physician? Right. Now he's going to get after me with what I'm saying today.
I teach at Central Washington University.
Okay. Any of the same people can tell me what their grandparents did?
They were all farmers.
Farmers.
Railroad.
Railroad.
Own a store.
Own a store.
Farmers.
Farmers.
Farmers and
nurse.
Aspen.
Steel factory.
Carl Sandburg wrote a poem about Chicago that people were butchers of hogs and hewers of something or other, whatever. And it was all about ingots of steel, and in other words, 1920, 1910, probably 70-80% of the people made something, either on the farm or in the factory, because we needed goods to be produced. Now it is exactly the opposite. 70% of the people make their living serving one another. Daniel Bell predicts that by the year 2000, 10% of our population will be able to make all the goods that the 100% of us need. Now, what are the other 90% going to be doing? Why do you think this is so?
Yeah.
That we have so many people in service professions, not simply the helping professions, although that's a large part of it, but handling paper and communications, as innkeepers, and on, whereas a period ago, most everybody was making something. What are some of the reasons? Some are fairly, should be obvious.
Mm-hmm. It's easier work, physically at least.
Mm-hmm.
They were
made in the third world countries.
All right. Part of it is that we've done some of the nasty, I don't know how many of you have shoes on that are made in the United States. I've been very few. And a lot of our clothes are no longer made here. And our watches, and well, we could go on that we put into third world countries where labor is cheap and unorganized. A lot of the goods that we consume. And the other aspect is technology. Which was
farming, especially.
Right. In all areas of life have been technologized so that it takes less people to produce. What do we think about this? The fact that fewer of us have to make things and more of us can go into service or serving or helping.
Seems like everybody needs some sort of outlet to make something. You know, maybe people have to find other routes to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't making it for a living.
Yeah. Often, it's heralded as a pathway to the good society. We don't have to drudge over this constructive this labor. We can spend our time helping each other to provide services for each other, is to do good. And it is a blessing, and we can attend and care for each other. My contention, as you know by the title, is that this drift toward a service society is ominous or even dangerous. And so I want to look at some of the components of a service society and then raise some of the reasons why I think this is dangerous, and we'll get into a discussion. A service society has to have clients, users of services, and it has to have a professionalized society. It has to have professionals who provide services and institutions and agencies that link consumers with service providers. Now, we need clients, the first one. And how do we create clients? Well, just like we, or similarly anyway, to the way we created consumers of goods. We, just like people, found that they needed more and more things, from designer jeans to stereos to on and on, we could be made to really feel that we need those things. Well, so too, we can be made to need or feel we need services. How do we do that? Well, we need people who are deficient or deviant or ignorant or sick. Or actually, what we need is people who are made to feel deficient, deviant, ignorant or sick. See, since we don't need many more goods, our economic growth depends upon our capacity to identify more and more deficiencies. The more deficiencies you have, the more valuable you are to our society. You are making a contribution to our growth by your very deficiencies. Because our society needs. Because this is the only area of the society that is creating jobs, that is growing. If that 10% can make all the goods, then we've got to create needs. Now, our society depends a lot on young people and old people who can be defined as problems rather than as productive participants. I mean, in the old days, young person was young until they were 13 or 14. Now they're young until they're 32 when they finish graduate school. And old used to be old when you retired at 70, now you're getting old at 55 and get early retirement. So that you only have to really do productive work between 30 and 55. And you can have services to the young and old endlessly expanded. Well, it's not just the young and old that provide us with possibilities. Almost any condition can be defined as a problem in need of a service. There's a whole industry, for example, built around baldness. Now, I'm not sure why losing one hair became a disease or a deficiency that needed a whole industry of transplants and so forth. But it creates a great job industry. John McKnight, from whom I am indebted for much of these insights, talked about going to University of Minnesota, where he's talking to 500 people at a conference on gerontology. And he talked to some young people afterwards, and they were asked what they were going to be. They were going to be bereavement counselors. And he tried to explore it, and they were arguing that more and more people are saying that you really haven't solved the problem of grief unless you've had professional help in going through those stages. And pretty soon, more of us will feel unable to do that for our friends and relatives because it'll be a profession that will be handled much more adequately by someone who's trained in it. So traditional professions expand, new professions emerge, non-professional services mushroom, and we become, in ever-increasing areas of our lives, clients, dependent upon experts to fix our gadgets, to make us feel loved, to execute our foreign policy, and on and on. Okay, a service society is clientized, we all become clients, but it's also professionalized. You see, a client is one who believes that they will be better because someone else knows better. And a profession is that person who knows better. And clients and professionals go hand in hand. Professionals create clients, and clients need professionals. There was a time, I was told, when they were just the three professions, and they were looked on with some suspicion, almost as the wages of original sin. to help us come to terms with the adversity, the state, and God. Those were, of course, the professions of medicine, law, and ministry. But now we have thousands of professions. We no longer look upon them with suspicion. We exalt them. And in the health field alone now, in the directory, there are 370 professions. They say, many of them, of course, have their own journals and associations and on and on. So what is... There's a definition. A professional... One analyst put it this way. In the final analysis, professionalization is primarily an achievement of autonomy, which implies, one, knowing what's best for the client, two, subjecting one's decision only to peer review of colleagues, and three, establishing all standards of behavior through a professional association. This didn't come from a critic of the profession. This came from a professional association. This what defines of a profession. See, not only does a professional know what's best for the client, she or he knows what's wrong with the client. Now, in fact, managers, the Manager Foundation Perspective, a journal that comes out, says, people deserve to be helped. It is not a luxury, but a right. And it is the task of helpers in this day to invent new forms of giving help. So, of course, we've got to do that to create the jobs. Well, the third characteristic of a service society or professionalized society is the concentration of power in the hands of large bureaucratized professional groups, almost moving toward what might be called service monopolies. Medicine is a clear example of that. There was once a sort of cottage industry of solo practitioners, and now has moved toward corporate medicine, which is a complex mix of the insurance industry, drug industry, hospitals, medical suppliers, high-tech equipment, universities, government, and so forth. Big medicine, I think, is organized largely around the interests of the providers, I would say. And service bureaucracies tend to be organized around the interests and needs of the providers. And I'm going to spend more time tomorrow suggesting how this might be destructive of community. But this is the point I want to get to today and then discuss. If professionalized service society is, as I contend, dangerous, if it turns us into clients and we surrender power to institutions and if it, as I will contend tomorrow, destroys community, why don't we resist? Why don't we say, no, this is ridiculous? There ought to be other ways of sharing, dealing with these. Any ideas?
Excuse me, you're saying that by professionalizing this, the helping services?
We create, it becomes dangerous and destructive of community. It turns us into clients. And,
well, one of the reasons I see, and that's what I struggle with, is that because our society is so sophisticated and so demanding financially and just practically, if you have the interest to want to help people and you do desire that, but then you have no source of income, then you're left, you know, there's not very much, many communities who will take care of you in just a large city or in a small town, you know, that can allow you to be sustained and yet helping outside of the realm of having maybe a job.
Right. You're suggesting that we are sort of forced by the market into the professionalized roles.
And even just by the complexity of our own society.
That's where the jobs are.
We need money to survive and we need all the other things to do what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was thinking of why don't we resist as a consumer? And it seems to me like the more we resist as a consumer, the more the system can tell us we really need it. And we've got a problem that we don't want to...
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, every time I get a cold and don't go to the doctor, people tell me I'm crazy because I don't go to the doctor. Well, it's a cold. It'll pass in 7 days one way or the other. You know, but they think I'm nuts. No.
It's also very popular to get help. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the other thing that keeps people from resisting it is that we have a mindset that we want the highest quality. We want the highest quality pair of jeans. We want the specialist. We want the person who knows the most about every aspect of our lives taking care of us.
Mm-hmm. One person has suggested, and I think this is close to it, is what you just said. Services are a commodity of care. And care is an expression of love. And who can be against love? Who can be against more service, more caring? It's hard. Services are almost immune from political debate because they are seen as a means of caring, of helping, of loving people. Nothing is too good. I mean, no expense too, because a life is at stake or someone has a problem. The expansion of services takes place behind the mask of love. Now, it may be, but behind that mask is also jobs and control of jobs. Some of you, and even some who are a little younger than I am, still remember the poverty program that John F. Kennedy talked about and Lyndon Johnson put into play. And we're going to solve the problem of poverty in the United States in our urban and rural areas, and we were going to help millions. And to do this, how did we solve poverty? We marshaled an army of helpers, teacher aides, and caseworkers, and counselors, and mental health workers, and nurses, and therapists, and recreation supervisors, and police aides, and land use planners, and on. Now, if the poor were not particularly helped, and I think there's evidence that they were not, they didn't get any money, that another group of people was helped. The army of helpers. See, we had, at that time, the civil rights movement, and a growing number of black people wanted some jobs, and we had a sort of idealism out of the Kennedy era, and a growing number of people wanted to help. And basically, the poverty program turned out to be a jobs program. Behind the mask of service of the poor was a very real need we have in our country, still have, to provide jobs. And the poor have always been a major source of the provision of jobs. We could look at the healthcare system briefly as a system of caring for health. Our medical system is questionable. You know, you look at the national indices and they're 19th in one category and 17th among industrialized nations and 15th and so forth on infant mortality and other things. We should be doing better than that. So probably as a health system, it's not that great for the whole of society, but it's an industry with 12% of the gross national product and creation of jobs. It is a great success. So it would seem to be that the health industry is guided, if not as much, if not more, as a growth business, providing jobs for lots of people, and as by its ability to deal with some of the basic health needs of our society. So behind the mask of love is a and service systems are the need of, for clients and a professional's need for money. See, I tell a lot of my students in the urban studies program that basically you're all superfluous. Society doesn't need you. And that's, you know, because I mean, your grandparents, they needed, because they needed food. And so we're going to have to dream up jobs. And it's worthwhile, because it's better than giving you welfare when you graduate from college. So get into some kind of helping profession and try not to do too much damage. And it's a good way of distributing income. Well, that's a little irreverent way to put it, but maybe we can deal with that on Wednesday when we raise the question, can helping professionals be saved? But specifically, Why is service society dangerous? 3 points. It becomes, professional service becomes a substitute for politics. It becomes a denial of authentic caring, and it obscures issues of social justice. Professional service as a substitute for politics transforms people into patients, citizens into clients, social problems into illnesses, problem solving into therapies, politics into technical administration. You see, in a political way of dealing things, people as citizens defining and addressing social problems together. A professional way, you have clients with illnesses and deficiencies who are treated or managed. John McKnight, I think, whom I mentioned before, wrote very tellingly about this, what he calls the therapeutic ideology. Put it this way, in the therapeutic ideology, the basic problem is you. And the resolution of your problem is my professional control. And my control is your help. The essence of the medical ideology is its capacity to hide control behind the magic cloak of therapeutic help. The power of this mystification is so great that the therapeutic ideology is being adopted and adapted by other interests that recognize that their control mechanisms are dangerously overt. Thus, medicine is the paradigm for modernized domination. Indeed, its cultural hegemony is so potent that the very meaning of politics is being undermined. In other words, that's when they say we're medicalizing a lot of issues. That is, we're putting their solutions in the hands of experts who define what is wrong, who define the solution. I suppose in the field of medicine, we can see this most clearly, but we can take other fields like ministry or teaching. But in medicine, we see the use of drugs to treat problems that, even by the doctor's own admission, are probably socially caused rather than psychological. A number of years ago, when I was looking at this more closely, two of the most widely prescribed drugs were Valium and Librium. What are they treating? We don't have a Valium deficiency, most of us. So they're probably treating some kind of anxiety we have that's caused in our homes, in our communities, in our workplace, and so forth. The American Medical Association, I was looking at that time when I was doing this over a lot of medical journals, and they have all these ads, as some of the physicians will know, in medical journals. And one of them, a classic ad I cut out, and still have children, a woman behind, they have a mop and a vacuum cleaner and a broom. It looks like she was behind bars, and she was forlorn and just wiped out with straggly hair. And the ad says you can't set her free, but you can make her feel better. And then it was an advertisement for one of these psychoactive drugs. And basically, doctors are faced with people who come in with all sorts of problems, for which there's no chemical solution. There's a chemical way of hiding the problem. So we know that it's the tensions in society and at home, and the alienation at work, and the anxieties that we tend to treat these as illnesses, as pathological. Well, some of the same things, there are many examples of chemical solutions to social problems. And not just in medicine. The medical interpretation as it applies to the poor, for example. Neighborhoods are defined as sick and in need of cures, and the poor are seen as having weak ego strength, pre-conventional morality, limited time horizon, ambivalence toward property, and propensity to crime. And they're defined in certain ways as to say that there's nothing wrong with society, with the arrangements in society. The arrangements of control. There is something wrong with the poor, which requires a kind of therapy. So this is how politics is replaced. Politics, which would call for sort of organized struggle and redistribution of some kind, often becomes replaced by service. Professional service, in the second place, is a denial sometimes of authentic care. Service becomes a commodity that often becomes a substitute for care. Now again, not to pick on the medical system, we find that the medical system may not promote that much health. But since it can't provide health, of course it can't provide health, we're in control as much as anybody of our health, the medical system, through a displacement of gold, provides something else. It provides access to medicine, access to medical services. So access to institutionalized services becomes a substitute commodity. So you have medicine for health. You have a schooling for education, or policing for security, legal services for justice, and church for salvation or liberation. So that participation in the institution and what the institution can offer becomes sometimes a substitute for the authentic kind of original goal of that institution. Illich pushes this further. Ivan Illich wrote a book called Medical Nemesis, which is fascinating, because he said medicine not only is a substitute for health, it can be detrimental to health. And he argued that expansion of medical system is illness producing. Not simply because of over-medication and stuff you pick up in hospitals and all that, but it is illness producing because it strips people of their capacity to help themselves and to help each other by becoming totally dependent upon the professionals. We no longer know how to deal with pain and suffering and help others do it, or we lose that capacity. In other areas, it is that there are sides where professional or experts are counterproductive. We see it where urban renewal just began to create new slums, where public housing began to create more problems than it solved, where the welfare system generated welfare dependency. And the solutions of the experts fail, but the failure is blamed on the client, and the client is increasingly powerless to discover or act upon the real sources of the problem. In the guise of help and care, services then often become help denying because they expropriate power from the individual. And finally, services often obscure the issues of social justice. And I'll make this very brief. See, in a service society, there's that love, care, service connection. And sort of that obscures the fundamental issues of power and justice and redistribution. You might contrast a service society with a justice-seeking society. And in a service society, the concentrations of power are hidden by the mask of love. In a justice society, power is exposed and dealt with up front. Service society has a high regard for the goodwill of the service providers, and they trust the experts. And a justice-seeking society realizes that goodwill is always tainted by self-interest, and that when unchecked, can become justice-denying. Never trust the experts. Never trust those who are going to help you. They may help you, but never trust their intentions completely, because it's all life's intentions are always mixed, especially when there's a price tag on it. I mean, I'm always suspicious. I wonder if let's say if a doctor gets $1,000 for cutting off my leg and only $10 for cutting off my toe, then he gives me the advice. You know, I always behind that his advice, I realize that there's a self-interest involved. Now, and also in interesting. Let me see. Service society regards equity as the price of inequity, rather, unequal, as sort of the price of progress. That we'll make up that later. And a justice society is very much concerned about inequities at the start. And in a service society, ethical inquiry is often focused on the interface between the service systems and the client. And you deal with right to life and right to death and malpractice and retributions and right to drugs and right to services and protection of services. And so the therapeutic ideology triumphs when the only questions that are asked are the questions of how to be a good professional, how to be a good client, and how to have good institutions. You see, in a justice society, the issues would be where, how should power and resources be distributed? And they would be concerned about service institution monopolizing, as you said, possibilities and resources. I think there are many ways we could see our professional services sometimes obscure, postpone, or deflect our concern for justice. I think we see this in institutional religion, that the church gets so involved in the church that the goal of sisterhood or brotherhood gets lost because it resorts to this kind of individualized religion and doesn't then deal with what it is to be a people. And I think all of our services, the danger of professionalized services is it becomes individualized. I'm the helper, you're the problem, I'll help you, and it's a financial transaction. And then there's so many of the real problems are social problems. Now, I've taken more than I thought I would, but we have about 25 minutes to kick this around. And let me just say that tomorrow I want to really look at how professional help really undercuts and destroys community. And then Wednesday maybe look at... then Wednesday leave this wide open and say, what do we, all of us who are in professions, do about it? I mean, I'm in the same boat. I want more and more students to come to the Urban Studies program, and I'll try to make them feel like they need to come to the city because my bread and butter depends upon students coming to my services. And so we're all in this game of trying to be create clients. How can, and then I think Wednesday, how can we do it in a different way? Okay, let's, who wants to lead on any direction we just touched? Yeah.
Is this a symptom of the problem you're mentioning that, for example, it seems in medicine that the emphasis is more on curing than on prevention? I don't know how it is now, but for a long time anyway, the medical insurance people would not pay for a physical exam, only for an illness.
Sure.
I think that seems to me like a symptom of the problem.
Yeah, I know. I went talked to a doctor who was told this person, what you really need, because you're just eating junk food, you need some vegetables, and you need some fruit, and you need this. She said, I can't afford it. But if you wrote her out a prescription, she could take it down and be paid for by green card. But they aren't going to pay for fresh fruits and vegetables, right, what she needed. It's that idea that with an insurance system, there's an incentive to use the therapies and the modalities that will be reimbursed. And so there becomes a kind of monopoly. If you're a naturopath or a massage or into various kinds of nutritional or alternative therapies, it may not be.
And even going into the counseling area, if you're going to get third-party payments, you have to go by the DSM-3, which is the psychiatric Bible that gives labels for each illness or each problem. You can't just go in having some developmental issue that you need to work on or some conflict resolution. It has to be a medical label.
Right. So that's part of the thing is labeling.
Yes.
You've got to find deficiencies. Or in Northwestern, they did an experiment with some graduate students who were in the counseling and the clients came in, but they weren't allowed, the counselors weren't allowed to see the file. And they threw up their hands and said, how can I help this person? If I haven't looked at the file, don't know what they have. You know. You know, of course, the implication, you might talk with them, but no, you might ask them. But I mean, it was very threatening for them to be thrown into a room with somebody who they didn't have a label for and have a chart on. Yeah.
I just thought it was interesting. The gentleman over there said that, I think everyone in our society now believes that, that medicine should be more directed toward prevention. But that's just exactly what you're saying is a problem. Doctors have traditionally been trained to take care of sick people, not to prevent us from getting sick. That's our responsibility.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's saying that we need professional help in preventing us from getting sick. Okay? And you just agreed with him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's
no.
Doctors know this. We're getting something put on us.
Okay. Listen, you're saying, and I think you're right, doctors are getting a bum rap because you are trained in sickness and how to deal with sickness. And you're being asked often how to keep people healthy. And
that just passed by the group here.
Okay. Everybody now, if he's right, the suggestion was, well, this is a whole new business. Aha! Health professionals, wellness centers, jogging groups, hospitals. Hospitals that have now become empty now have wings of them turned over with aerobic exercise equipment and weight loss programs and smoking clinics and all of these.
That's not driven by the professional. That's driven by the client. I think one of the things I want to ask you is how much of this is driven by the client and how much is driven by the professional. Take serum cholesterols, for example. Believe it or not, the overwhelming worry right now that people have about their serum cholesterol that's just happened in the past year or two is coming from the client. It's really not coming from the professional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got people now who have perceived that they need to have their cholesterols under a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
And they've extracted that need from some data that's been in the newspapers that a lot of doctors don't buy, but the public demand is there. And you're not a good doctor unless you somehow help this person get their serum cholesterol down.
You're suggesting, and it might be true, that increasingly a lot of people are pulling away from the medical professional, getting some suspicion about it for a variety of reasons in the last 5 or 10 years, popular press and so forth. And maybe the realization that the answer to our health does not lie in the medical profession. John McKnight, who I referred to, said he went down to a meeting in Mexico with a lot of high-powered doctors. It was this about 10 years ago, this big think tank thing. And someone, they were asking, what do you do about the health in this country, the medical system? And someone said, one of the doctors said, you could double, triple, quadruple the budget on the medical system, and you wouldn't significantly change the health indices of our country. What he was saying is, what are the determinants of health? And he blew a little. Well, that's good. Drew a box. One more jack. He drew a box. And he said, there's 4 determinants of health. And he called one of the I determinant. That's what I do, whether I smoke, whether I exercise, and that's one of the determinants of my health. The other determinant he called the we determinant, how I get along with my spouse, my children, my boss, it's the stress of relationships, and a lot of that is under our collective control. The other he referred to the environment, the noise, the air, the additives in the food, the impurities in the water, all of those things are determining my health. And a fourth determinant was the therapeutic system. But he said, you could expand this system and you would probably not significantly change the health. And he said, a lot of people are saying that the change in our health is going to happen because of what we do in our environment, in our relationships, and in our lifestyles. And so this is where the dramatic changes will come when Canada had a non-doctor, and they're allowed to do that, the head of the health system in Canada was not a doctor, a guy named Lalonde, I think it was, a couple of years ago, and he looked at the health budget, and he tried to reduce, he looked at the major indices, and of course it was, he finally concluded that seatbelts, gun control would be better expenditures, and anti-smoking campaign would be better expenditures of public money than would expanding this system. So because it was in these areas, in the environment and in our communal relationships and our personal habits, that we had a chance of being able to control our health. And I think out of that grew a feeling, though, maybe all the answers aren't with the doctors, and maybe we should use the doctors, like I did a couple of weeks ago, to do arthroscopic surgery and take some chunks out of my knee, which, by the way, I ruined doing all this running, trying to take care of my health. That's all of a sudden, that dawned on me is counterproductive. But we should use doctors to be like we should use plumbers to fix certain things. But we call upon doctors whenever we don't feel. We have dis-ease. We don't feel right. And said, doctor, help me. And he doesn't want to turn you around and say, listen, straighten that out with your husband. So he says, sure, take this.
John, I hope you don't mind, but I'd like to take it on a different track. And that is, what alternatives do we promote? I feel like I've been interested in and been wanting to do and have done care and service work for the past 6 years, always outside of the system for the very reasons you're speaking of. I felt like making a commodity where money is exchanged just for me took the love and took the gospel message out of it for me. So I've done that, and yet it takes a lot of creative energy to survive still outside of that system. Yeah. And to try to continue to put up with the demands. And then even the way people interact with you, it's like, oh, well, you're 29 and you're still doing volunteer work. It's like, well, when are you going to get a real job? And when are you going to finally get your credentials and then do that in a way that you're considered a professional? And actually, I mean, you know, whether I was in the system or not, it's the same kind of work, but it's very hard to keep doing it, you know, with the love element and not the financial element.
Yeah. Yeah. There'd be, others might answer this better. There'd be two questions. How do we do what you call the real jobs, that is the paying jobs, in ways that don't create dependencies and empower people. And I think that see our limits as helpers and don't overexpand our system. We can ask that question. The other question to ask is for those who want an alternative to that job in the bureaucracy. Because we can ask, how do we do that job in the bureaucracy better and more humanely? But you're asking also, how do we? Are there ways of getting outside that? Does anybody? Churches may find some ways.
Aren't you going with that story of the man who, for several years, kept going to the, couldn't get into the water, and Jesus says, "Do you want to be healed?" Uh-huh. And isn't this what we're running against? Are these people, do they want to be healed? Or wouldn't they rather go to the therapist or to someone to tell their troubles to, who they really think they can trust, rather than trusting other people and their relations and their community and the friends, acquaintances, or their neighbors? Many of the people I run across just really don't want to be healed. They don't want to be whole, because they have really enjoyed the idea of being sick. You know, it gives them this handle of being somebody, being unique.
Right. We become sufficiently impotent, crippled, so we become really dependent. That's the triumph of a therapeutic society. Is when we all become professionals and clients, and we cease to become citizens. Citizens, John McGuy poses the two questions. On one hand, there's a group of citizens, or do you have a group of clients? Citizens have power, they fight with each other, they argue, they make clients are powerless, and so forth. Now, you're suggesting that increasingly, as we become clientized, we accept that. Yeah.
Well, I think there's two things that both of these people, that they're kind of coming in like this on, that strikes me about this whole concept, is that one, we have a need for authority, and in our complex society, we tend to relinquish certain individual responsibilities that we have to an authority because they are the expert, like you said, and we cease to take on our own individual responsibilities. And I don't know how this, you know, if I'm going to a doctor and I feel like that we're not communicating, that I'm not getting well, it's also my responsibility to either talk to him or to change doctors or to do something else. I mean, there's a certain individual responsibility that we, it seems like to me, increasingly relinquish to this field of expertism.
Right.
And it's not just doctors, it's the counselors,
that's right.
It's the, I mean,
the minister will tell you what is right and wrong. No. That's right. We do relinquish.
Because we want, because we are living in a complex world and we can't.
Why?
We feel this fear of not keeping up, you know.
It gets overwhelming. I can't fix a car, I can't do a lot.
Right.
I find myself increasingly dependent upon so many people. And so the specialization is, well, I will at least carve out my niche as a professional and I'll make sufficient money so that I can be a client to a lot of other people. I mean, this is why maybe Holden is sort of subversive community, because it is a kind of community that tries to meet each other's needs. And why it is so sort of distinct from the outside world, where we go back into our niches of being professionals and clients. But you were going to say something.
Your original question was how can we change that? I think one of the practical ways to change it is to is what the person was saying, that what she does isn't considered financially valuable. I think one way to change it is to change what society feels is financially valuable, to put a different price on things. The person who did your arthroscopic surgery made more money doing that than a family physician makes in 2-3 days, taking care of everyday kind of problems.
He made $1,550,
right.
And
he
did six of them a day.
That's right. If our society says that's no longer worth that, because that person hasn't had any more training and isn't any smarter or anything else, and somebody even within their own profession who's doing a maybe more exhausting kind of emotional work,
mm-hmm.
with people, if they say that isn't worth $1,500 anymore, then they'll stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll stop doing it as readily on people. That's one of the first things that's got to stop. And so I think changing what we're willing to pay for things.
What would be the alternative? Like, if you have this problem, you need the surgery, you can't say, you know, I'm not going to pay it, so I'm not going to have it, because it's something you have to have.
Yeah.
Well, he thought he needed the surgery. Maybe he did.
Yeah.
But people in Nicaragua that have needs like that don't get surgery.
No, that's right.
That's true.
No, the other thing is, someone else other than the market might control. We'd hate to see that, don't we? How much people would be rewarded for various services. Right now, we leave it up to the market, you will charge whatever you can get away with for almost anything we do. So, but if, I know there are other societies where they train them just as well, and they probably do it with a different principle, because the doctors would be on salary.
I'm bothered by your cynicism a little of the system. Almost like to put in a plea for working constructively within the system to be of service. To instance, two chiropractors, we have back trouble. A furlough ago, a chiropractor made me feel like my back was going to pot. He said, degeneration of the vertebrae, etc., etc. Made me feel really bad about it. This furlough, I found chiropractor happened to be a Lutheran, I don't know if that had anything to do with it, who brought us together, my wife and I, showed us, knew that we were overseas, and showed us how we could help each other, relieve our each other's problems to some extent while we were overseas now.
Sure.
And gave me a whole new attitude about my back. You know, I feel like I've simply got a normal aging back now. And I felt like she was making a significant contribution within her field. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of pleading or proposing that it ought to be possible to make a serious Christian contribution against what you're saying from within the system and not be cynical about it.
Okay.
Maybe.
Now that, pursue that with some others. In other words, looking upon the client not as a bundle of deficiencies and I thrive upon their deficiencies, but as a someone with rich capabilities. Perhaps I could help release or help.
Maybe legally she was not even permitted to do that, to show us. I don't know, or to have someone.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure that that was.
But I think really that's what is being said by several people here in different ways. You're saying that somehow this chiropractor helped you discover your own resources.
Yeah.
Oh. And that's what I think this gentleman over here is saying too, that the consumer, we as consumers share some responsibility in this, and we need to begin to take this responsibility, ask questions, and not just give in to what is already out there, and begin to, you know, take some responsibility ourselves, recognize the resources we have within ourselves.
I heard a couple, the suggestion was strong that the system itself, well, it probably is sick in many ways, you know. It may be that I'm too willing to cooperate with the system that delivers these services for a fee. And yet, my first reaction to some of the things you're saying is that we do benefit in some ways from the system.
Well, my point was to be wary of the way in which it weakens us. It makes us dependent upon professionals. And the other point is that we tend to fall into that because we need jobs, and therefore we need clients. And so, now, given that, and I would say that's not quite cynicism, it's a kind of dose of realism from which we may begin to see now, how can we act as loving, caring people for each other? And there are ways, yeah, of course. Yeah.
But I don't think it's fair to say that everybody that's in the system is, that there isn't anybody in there who cares and who does it with love.
No. Right. See, I can say we live in a racist society, but obviously not everybody in our society, not probably, not most of them are racist. But the society, it becomes institutionalized in such a way that, so certainly, there's some genuine, loving, concerned, caring people in all these helping professions. That's why they went in. But it's just all these loving people end up doing sometimes is creating lots of dependencies. I was just comment on this health center I was involved in, the group of pediatricians, they were all on salary, and they didn't get any extra pay the more people that came through the turnstile. And so they started giving mothers these little things you look in babies' ears with, and that's an easy thing to do, to look in and see whether it's red or not. And they told mothers about the five things to look at, and so then they encouraged, hey, call me up on the phone, don't bother coming in. If you notice something, let's talk about it. So it was. So a lot of the mothers felt by the end that they put in much new, half a dozen of the basic things, and the providers became sort of trainers of the.
That's precisely what I had in mind before in talking about preventive kind of medicine. But I'd take another kind of preventive therapy, a pastor doing counseling. Well, he's not there to tell the person the answers. He's not the answer. person. He or she is the person who shows the one who comes how to use the resources that they have of their faith. And they've got them. They're people of faith, and they've got the resource, and just don't know quite how to use it. That's the kind of helping, perhaps, you would like to see happening, mm-hmm. I think. Well, I would anyway.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could begin to organize our church fellowships a little more creatively so that we build a kind of nucleus of help by exchanging of goods or exchanging of services within that group. And I think, isn't it the Church of the Risen Savior in Washington that does some of that, and very successfully? And we should look at that as an approach, perhaps.
Right. No, there is a... Well, I know some churches now that want to help all these Central Americans now that can't get jobs because of the new immigration law are developing cooperatives so that they begin to find many ways of helping each other. So often we do learn from the outcasts because people who are... I learned a lot from Guatemala when I found that they use their health budget really to train health workers to get clean water and to... and in Nicaragua, what they did with a very limited health budget in terms of changing significantly indices of national health. So we can learn from people who are marginalized of how they solve problems with less. Part of the problem is that we have so many resources that we say, hey, why not use them all? John, were you going to...
Well, I was just going to say that I think that it would be possible for somebody to take the opposite position of your brother, Pete Cameroon here, who and say you haven't been cynical enough that that in fact it is worse than you've painted, John. That in fact some of the elements of the worsening power of the helping professions in those institutions that bother me most are in the institutions that define these things, which are universities and professional schools. And it's directly in the interest of professional schools to keep making these bodies of knowledge more and more obscure, right? And to keep creating languages that only professionals can understand. And when you look at this stuff, you know, when you're in, anybody who's honest who goes through any of these schools or looks at the curriculum, understands that what's going on here is the sort of commodification of common sense, right? It's stuff we all know.
That's because you got your PhD in sociology, and that's what sociology is.
It's stuff we all know that gets codified into language that nobody, people who are sort of entering into the priesthood, right, then can understand. And so part of it is the language thing. Part of it is a mindset. But there's an awful lot of interest in keeping that stuff going.
Right.
I mean, the codependency language, Billy, where was that 10 years ago? I mean, if you delve into that, right, it's really just common sense stuff. But there is a whole sort of ideology and language around that now that you get taught in graduate schools, right?
All graduate schools end up, I think you're right, to be classes in language and how to learn an esoteric language and then enter into the club. So one of the ways, not only breaking down labeling, but demystifying the professional control, because it is around control of a body of secret knowledge, which you're saying, in many cases, is flim-flam.
Yeah, I think one of the most subversive things we all can do is just make fun of the professions. You know, I mean, all the professional jokes we have, tell them all the time. Make up new ones.
Right.
Make sure that none of us were.
And that's how we build community.
Being laughed at.
Because we laugh at it, and this is maybe we'll talk about tomorrow, because that's how you build community, because then you realize with some laughter with others, hey, we're handling it that, and they're the problem, not us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right, I think it's about 8 minutes to, the bell will ring momentarily. And so I will try tomorrow, Jody, to be much more cynical.
Good.
And we will deal with how professional help destroys community.